Hello, friends, and welcome to another edition of Social Studies on the Go. This is going to be Module 7, Lesson 5, Jefferson Becoming President. But first, we'd like to start with something funny. What is Jefferson's favorite type of dessert? That is Montagello. Okay, here we go. The election of 1800. In the presidential election of 1800, Anti-Federalist John Adams and Charles C. Pinckney ran against Democratic Republicans Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr, notorious Aaron Burr. Each party believed that the American Republic's survival depended upon the success of their candidates. Sound familiar? With so much at stake, the election was hotly contested. Unlike today, candidates do not travel around giving speeches. Instead, the candidate's supporters made their arguments in letters and newspaper editorials. Adams' supporters claimed that Jefferson was a pro-French radical. Put Jefferson in office, they warned, and the violence and chaos of the French Revolution would surely follow in the United States. In addition, Federalists argued that Jefferson's interest in science and philosophy proved that he wanted to destroy organized religion. Democratic Republican newspapers responded that Adams wanted to crown himself king. What else, they asked, could be the purpose of the Alien and Sedition Acts? Republicans also hinted that Adams would use the newly created permanent army to limit Americans' rights. When the election results came in, Jefferson and Burr had won 73 electoral votes, each to 65 for Adams and 64 for Pinckney. The Democratic Republicans had won the election, but the tie between Jefferson and Burr caused a problem. Under the Constitution at that time, the two candidates with the most votes became president and vice president. Yikes. The decision went to the House of Representatives, as called for in the Constitution. The House, like the Electoral College, also deadlocked. Days went by as vote after vote was called, each ending in ties. Exhausted lawmakers put their heads on their desks and slept between votes. Some napped on the House floor. Jefferson finally won on the 36th vote. The election marked the first time that one party had replaced another in power in the United States. The problems with the voting system led Congress to propose the 12th Amendment. This amendment created a separate ballot for president and vice president. Jefferson in office. When Jefferson took office, he brought with him a style and political idea different from those of Adams and Washington. Jefferson was less formal than his predecessors, and he wanted to limit the powers of government, supposedly. Jefferson is inaugurated. Americans looked forward with excitement to Jefferson's first speech as president. People from across the nation gathered in the new capital, Washington, D.C., to hear from him. Curious travelers looked with pride at the partially completed Capitol and at the Executive Mansion, not yet called the White House. The two buildings dominated the surrounding homes and forests. Small businesses dotted the landscape. At one of these, a modest boarding house, the president-elect was putting the finishing touches on his speech. On the morning of March the 4th, 1801, he left the boarding house and walked to the Capitol. The leader of a republic, Jefferson believed, should not ride in fancy carriages. Jefferson read his speech in a quiet voice. He wanted to make it clear that he had supported the will of the majority. He also stressed the need for a limited government and the protection of civil liberties. From these humble surroundings in which Jefferson delivered his speech, Washington eventually grew into a large and impressive city. Over the years, the Capitol and the Executive Mansion were joined by other state buildings and monuments. Jefferson, who had long dreamed of a new national capital that would be independent of the interests of any one state, was pleased to be a part of this process of building a federal city. Jefferson makes changes. President Jefferson faced the task of putting his Republican ideas into practice. one of his first actions was to select the members of his cabinet. His choices included James Madison as Secretary of State and Albert Gallatin as Secretary of the Treasury. Jefferson would also benefit from the Democratic Republican Party newly won control of both houses of Congress. At Jefferson's urging, Congress allowed the hated Alien and Sedition Acts to expire. Jefferson lowered military spending and reduced the size of the army. The Navy was cut to 7 active ships. Jefferson and Gallatin hoped that saving this money would allow the government to repay the national debt. Jefferson also asked Gallatin to find ways to get rid of domestic taxes, like the tax on whiskey. The Democratic Republican-led Congress passed the laws needed to carry out these policies. The entire national government in 1801 consisted of only several hundred people. Jefferson preferred to keep it that way. He believed that the primary functions of the federal government were to protect the nation from foreign threats, deliver the mail, and collect customs duties. The rest of it was pretty much state and individual. Jefferson did recognize that some of the Federalist policies, such as the creation of the Bank of the United States, should be kept. Although Jefferson had battled Hamilton over the bank, as president he agreed to leave it in place. Here's another big switch when he becomes president. The Louisiana Purchase. Jefferson wanted to expand the borders of the United States. One problem that the young nation faced was that it had no ports on the Gulf of Mexico. Farmers in western areas had to ship their crops on boats down the Mississippi to the Port of New Orleans. The Port of New Orleans was controlled by Spain. In 1801, in a secret treaty, Spain gave the Louisiana Territory back to France. This was to calm Napoleon down and get him off their back. Louisiana Territory was a huge area to the west of the Mississippi that included New Orleans, the city. Jefferson feared that France would close New Orleans to American trade. So he sent James Monroe to Paris to try to purchase New Orleans. The French, however, offered to sell all of the Louisiana Territory to the United States for just $15 million. Monroe quickly agreed. Finalized in 1803, the Louisiana Purchase more than doubled the size of the United States. The Louisiana Purchase was a remarkable bargain. However, it raised many questions. The U.S. Constitution made no mention of buying foreign lands. As a strict constructionist, Jefferson was troubled that he might be overstepping his power. However, common sense told him that the purchase was a good idea. He and his advisors decided that the right to acquire territory was part of the president's constitutional power to make treaties. Some Federalists in Congress, however, called the Louisiana Purchase unconstitutional. Yet even Hamilton agreed that the purchase was good for the country. Congress quickly gave its approval. Jefferson wanted Americans to learn more about the lands the Louisiana Purchase. He asked his secretary, Meriwether Lewis, to lead an expedition to gather information about the territory. Lewis invited experienced frontiersman, William Clark, to join him as co-leader. In May of 1804, Lewis and Clark led about 30 frontier soldiers from their camp in St. Louis, northwest up the Missouri River. By October, the group, called the Corps of Discovery, had reached what is now North Dakota. One member of the Corps was York, an enslaved African owned by William Clark. York was a very skilled hunter. A Shoshone Indian woman named Sacagawea agreed to guide the expedition when it reached Shoshone land near the Rocky Mountains. In November of 1805, after traveling more than 3,000 miles, the Corps of Discovery reached the Pacific Ocean. They finally got back to St. Louis in September of 1806. Newspaper reports of their journey and the detailed journals they published made many Americans want to travel west. The Supreme Court. Although Republicans controlled the presidency and Congress, Federalists dominated the federal judiciary. In an effort to continue their control over the judiciary, Federalist legislators passed the Judiciary Act of 1801, shortly before their terms of office ended. This act created 16 new federal judgeships that President Adams filled with Federalists before leaving office. The Republican press referred to these people as midnight judges. They argued that Adams had packed the judiciary with Federalists the night before he left office. Some of these appointments were made so late that the documents that authorized them had not been delivered by the time Adams had left office. This led to a controversy once Jefferson took office. William Marbury, named as a Justice of the Peace by President Adams, did not receive his documents before Adams left office. When Adams took office, Marbury demanded the documents. On Jefferson's advice, however, the new Secretary of State, Madison, refused to deliver them. Jefferson argued that the appointment of the midnight judges was not valid. Marbury brought suit, asking the Supreme Court to order Madison to deliver the appointment papers. Marbury claimed that the Judiciary Act of 1789 gave the Supreme Court the power to do so. John Marshall, a Federalist appointed by John Adams, was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Chief Justice Marshall and President Jefferson disagreed about many political issues. When Marshall agreed to hear Marbury's case, Jefferson protested. He said that the Federalists have retired into the judiciary as a stronghold. Marshall wrote the court's opinion in Marbury v. Madison. This case helped establish the Supreme Court's power to check the power of the other branches of government. The Constitution, Chief Justice Marshall noted, gave the Supreme Court authority to hear only certain types of cases. A request like Marbury's was not one of them. The law, the Judiciary Act of 1789, that Marbury's case depended upon was therefore unconstitutional. In denying Marbury's request in this way, the court avoided a direct confrontation with Jefferson's administration. But more importantly, it established the court's power of judicial review, the power to declare an act of Congress unconstitutional. Marshall and later federal judges would use this power of judicial review to make the judiciary a much stronger part of the national government. And that concludes our segment of Social Studies on the Go. I hope you and your family are safe during this time period, and we miss you much. We'll talk to you soon.